Rita Winecoop's nearly nude body was found face down on an operating table in elderly Dr. Winecoop's basement surgery, wrapped in a heavy blanket, shot through the breast. On the table near her head lay a revolver covered with a cloth. There were chloroform burns on Rita's face. On the floor at the foot of the operating table lay Rita's neatly folded clothing. The story of Rita Winecoop's murder was a sensational one from the beginning. Dr. Alice Winecoop, her mother-in-law and landlord, was a prominent Chicago physician, clubwoman, and social service worker. Rita was young, beautiful, red-haired, and a talented violinist. Her husband, Dr. Alice's son, Earl, was a handsome young Lothario. This is the story of Rita's murder and the woman convicted as her killer, 61-year-old Dr. Alice Lois Lindsay Winecoop. I'm your host, Laura. Listen closely because it's difficult to know if what I say is fact or fiction. Ready to play? Welcome to Fact or Fiction. I am delighted to introduce today's guest, my mother, Sherry. Hi, Mom. How's it going?
Hi, Laura. Excellent. I'm excited to play this game with you.
Yay. Well, that's awesome because I'm excited to have you. I was going to ask, I know you guys just had your second COVID vaccine. So have you been able to make it out and about, or are you still stuck at home?
Oh, no. We're out and about. We went to eat out last night. Mm-hmm. The first time that we ate inside in a restaurant.
Wow.
Yes. It was excellent.
Fun. It's nice to be around people, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Good. All right. Well, let's get started. So before we begin, Mom, I'll review the rules of fact or fiction just quickly. So I'll tell you a crazy true crime story that is based on printed information, and I'll add one of my own little fibs to it. And then at the end of the story, I will ask you to guess what part I made up. So I assume you know how to do this because you've done the others, I know.
Yes.
Okay. Well, as you may have guessed from the introduction, which I have quoted almost entirely from Chicago novelist Craig Rice, the topic of today's podcast features a real murder mystery worthy of the game Clue. It involves a cast of characters not usually involved in crimes, and there is lots of conflicting information. The woman convicted of the murder, Dr. Alice Lois Lindsay Winecoop, is a fascinating lady who may or may not have murdered her daughter-in-law, Rita Winecoop, her husband, Frank, an elderly lodger, and her adopted daughter, Mary Louise. As we will find out, Dr. Alice was smart, determined, opinionated, socially conscious, and brave. Not words typically used to describe someone who would murder their innocent daughter-in-law. My personal opinion is that she took the fall for someone else in Rita's murder, and the rest of the deaths were the result of natural causes. But I may be wrong because she was convicted of Rita's murder, and Murderpedia lists the other deaths as suspicious. So in 1933, at the time of Rita's murder, 61-year-old Dr. Alice lived in a 15-room mansion that she and Dr. Frank, so I'm going to call these people by their first names and say Dr., like Dr. Alice and Dr. Frank and Dr. Catherine and Dr. Gilbert, and because the whole Winecoop family, like they were all physicians.
Interesting.
Not the whole, but there was like a whole slew of them, and they were actually highly respected in the medical community in Chicago. 61-year-old Dr. Alice lived in the 15-room mansion she and Dr. Frank, her husband, had built to raise their family. The house that most newspapers in 1933 described as dark and gloomy, it had been the dream home of Dr. Alice and her husband, Dr. Frank. In 1933, after the children were grown and Dr. Frank had passed away, the home's residents included Dr. Alice, her daughter, Dr. Catherine Winecoop, who was working as an intern at a Chicago hospital, a lodger named Enid Hennessy, and her son, Earl, and his bride of 3 years, our victim, Rita Winecoop. Plus, there may have been a handyman who lived in the basement, but I found conflicting reports on that.
Okay. Yeah. The handyman's suspicious.
Yeah, I thought so too, but they apparently ruled him out because I think I mentioned it earlier, the murder occurred in the basement where Dr. Winecoop had her her medical practice. She had like an office and a little surgery table. And I think on the website, I'll post a diagram of where the body was found.
So she had a basement surgery.
Yes.
Basically.
Yes, okay. She did. Yeah. And the mansion was 3 stories tall. And so the main floor was like the main living room. And the second floor was the bedrooms. And then the third floor is where she had her own private office. And I assume Dr. Frank had an office up there too at one point. Dr. Frank, Alice's husband of 29 years, had passed away on January 2nd, 1929 at the age of 62. Now, I said they were both doctors. Their nicknames for each other were Docs. She called him Docs and he called her Doxy. So I thought that was cute.
It is.
Yeah, that's sweet. Anyway, according to Dr. Catherine, there was an influenza epidemic the fall and winter of 1928 and 1929. And Dr. Frank had worked nonstop through the season helping patients. So they had rarely seen him that winter. But in a weird happenstance, he had taken January 1st off, New Year's Day, to spend with his family. And Catherine recalls that it was a lovely day where the whole family all discussed their plans for the upcoming year. Unfortunately, he passed away in bed that evening. At the time, it was considered a tragic death due to heart disease. After Rita's murder, though, the newspapers declared that it had been a murder, that Alice had committed to obtain his life insurance policy, even though I personally think that Dr. Frank, who was gainfully employed as a physician, was probably worth more to the family alive than dead. But that's just me.
I would think. Plus, she had her own money as well.
She did. But now think about the timing here. This is 1929. January 1929. So we all know what happened in October of 1928. That was the stock market crash. That was Black Friday, right?
Black Friday. Okay. Yes. Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the year following Dr. Frank's death wasn't all doom and gloom for the family, though. That's the year Earl, their young son, met the pretty Rita, the Titchen-haired violinist. Every time I hear Titchen-haired, I think of Nancy Drew. Do you remember that? She's a titchen-haired blonde. They always described her that way.
I have no idea what that is.
It's red-haired. Yeah, I had to look it up. I think I remember reading it when I was like, you know, fifth grade. And I was like, oh, what is titchen? And I was like, oh, it means red hair.
Okay.
Yeah. So according to, and that's another funny thing. I didn't write this in here, but Dr. Alice is described as having brilliant red hair herself. I guess it's like a family trait. And maybe he just liked girls that look like his mom.
Not unusual.
Yeah, maybe. That's going to have some dark undertones here in a bit. But again, according to Dr. Catherine, Earl had been smitten with Rita the first moment he saw her playing at a concert that they all attended. She was playing violin at the concert. Dr. Alice, trying to help her son, had managed to get him an introduction to the girl. And after that, they had a long distance courtship. Eventually, he asked her to be his bride. And she said yes, and they showed up at the Wine Cube home, and Dr. Alice was thrilled. But then when she found out that Rita and Earl hadn't asked Rita's father permission for the marriage, she made them turn around and go back to Indianapolis and ask him for his permission.
Understandable.
Right. Well, so Rita apparently wasn't fond of her home life at that time. Her mother had died, I think it would have been about 10 years earlier, and her father had recently remarried. So, I mean, I can imagine that would be hard. You're a 20 and her father's remarried. And I think that would be difficult for any young woman. And her father is always described as a well-to-do flour and salt broker. I guess that's somebody who sells flour and salt.
I would think. And I think at that time, because of the using salt to preserve meats and things, mm-hmm. that a salt broker would be a fairly wealthy person.
That's probably true. I didn't think about that. After Rita's death, though, Rita's father, the wealthy, said he had not agreed to their marriage and that he had told them no because, quote, the boy didn't even have a job. Earl Winecoop, who with his sister Catherine had embarked on a career in medicine, had decided against it and was still living at home. He would be described after Rita's murder as a ne'er-do-well and Lothario, who at the time of her death operated a, quote, ride at the 1933 World's Fair. That makes it sound like he's just kind of a deadbeat loser who's working at, you know, operating a ride at the fair, right?
Yes, definitely.
Actually, he obtained his pilot's license in 1932, which is kind of a big deal in 1932, I would think.
I would think so.
He was passionately interested in photography. Another, like, color photography is actually what they said. And the ride he operated at the 1933 World Fair was the Sky Ride, which at the time was the height. See what I did there? Height. Sky okay. Ride. Height.
Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha.
Okay. Uh-huh. Really? You can't even give me a groan. Okay. Was the height of technological innovation. Dr. Catherine says this. Earl, along with some other aviators, had found employment on the Sky Ride. One day he took tickets, the next day he repaired the rocket cars. Not quite just the guy operating the Ferris wheel. But if you read the press clippings from after the murder, you'd think he was a deadbeat loser. And I'm not really sure that's exactly what was going on. I think he kind of had an entrepreneurial spirit. He was interested in technology.
What happened to Earl after his new wife's demise?
Yes, that's interesting. That, like, did he go on to kill a bunch more people?
I'm just wondering, what did he do career-wise? Did he continue to be a ne'er-do-well? Well, or what happened to this young man?
Yeah, so actually, I need to look it up to verify it, but I remember reading, I know he moved to California and lived to be a ripe old age. He married again. I don't think he had any children. And I'm pretty sure he worked for an aviation company there, and it may have been Boeing.
Oh, interesting.
Isn't that interesting? It was definitely an aviation company. He didn't just live off his mom his whole life, I don't think. Yeah, so part of it was, you would think that he's a deadbeat loser and that he was working at the fair to just pick up girls. That's the Lothario angle there, right? But Dr. Catherine said that Rita loved to fly with Earl, and he almost always took her with him on his outings. So the sister who lived there, who lived with the family, and admittedly, she was working as an intern at the hospital, so she probably wasn't home 100%, but she didn't get the sense that he was out cheating on his wife. Just throwing that out there.
Okay. And they'd only been married 3 years, correct?
Right. They weren't married that long. In spite of the happiness of the new couple, there was another death that happened in the Winecoop circle, and the papers cite it as suspicious. In August of 1932, Kate M. Porter, a 67-year-old, and this is a quote, spinster companion of Dr. Winecoop, died. Dr. Winecoop had the body cremated the same day she withdrew a $2,000 joint bank account she held with Miss Porter.
I think I missed something. How old was Miss Porter?
67.
Well, 67. I thought you said 17. And I thought, how could a 17-year-old be a spinster? Okay. 67. Okay. All right.
So yet another family tragedy occurred in March 1933 when Dr. Alice's adopted daughter, Mary Louise, died at the age of 23. What if I should go back and tell you how many kids they had at some point? Because you don't know that, do you?
No. But they had the adoptive daughter and at least two children and one adoptive daughter.
She had four children. The oldest son died. Then she had Walker, who didn't become a doctor. He told his daddy he had no interest in it. And he started up his own business making labels and apparently did very well. Then there was Earl, who married Rita. And then there was Catherine. And this story, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Catherine's birth and what happened afterwards. And this leads to the adoption. Apparently, after the birth of her fourth child and only girl, Catherine, in 1908, Dr. Alice was told that her health was far too fragile to maintain another pregnancy. She reportedly was distraught over the idea that Catherine was to grow up without a sister. And when they heard of a baby in 1909 in need of adoption, they jumped at the chance to add Mary Louise to their family. And when they were young, Catherine said she and Mary Louise were super duper close. Because of how much Mary Louise added to their family, or maybe just because Dr. Alice was concerned for the welfare of all children, Dr. Alice became an outspoken proponent of adoption. She hated the idea that children would be reared in orphanages instead of with families. So in 1912, she made national headlines when she spoke at a convention of the Mothers Congress, which, by the way, is now the PTA. Who knew? About the benefits of adoption and the responsibility of every financially secure man or woman, whether married or not, to adopt a child. The press had a field day with this, particularly in Chicago, where they contacted wealthy local bachelors to ask about their intentions to follow this plan. So to give you an idea of the response, here's a quote from one of the guys that they interviewed in the article. You tell that woman who is evidently talking through her bonnet that as far as I'm concerned, although I'm a batch, I am taking care of 10 or 12 now, and I think that's enough.
Ah, how is he taking care of 10 or 12?
Well, I take that to mean that he's got some illegitimate children, or maybe...
Wait a minute, illegitimate. Are you sure he's not taking care of siblings?
Oh,
or yeah, our nieces and nephews?
I don't know. I guess I just don't like this guy because he said she's talking through her bonnet when she's like a highly esteemed physician and she actually teaches medicine. So I'm a little defensive of this lady. So yes, you're probably right. But so, and by the way, listeners, mom kind of spit out her tea while I said that. So, all right. So you get the scent. What?
We just had a drink. It's all good.
Okay. You get the sense that the men, both newspaper reporters and the wealthy bachelors of Chicago, were less than respectful toward that woman. Dr. Ellis at the time was also involved in eugenics, the eugenics society. And you know what eugenics is, right, Mom? It's basically the extrapolation of Darwin's idea of evolution applied to humans and trying to find like the best and brightest humans to carry on the race, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is not popular today at all.
It isn't. Now we see it as unethical, cruel, and racist because some scientists did use it and some Nazis did use it to rationalize forced sterilization and genocide. But in the early 1900s, it was a rising field of biological science. And it was studied everywhere as a way to improve the welfare of future humans by eliminating disease. So I don't know. She might have been a horrible racist. I don't think so, because from everything I've read about her, she was willing to take care of patients for free. She encouraged other doctors to take care of patients for free. So she was kind of a caring person. I don't think she was prejudiced, but I could be wrong. In a 1912 Sacramento Star article, she is quoted as saying this. Now, listen carefully. Race suicide is widely practiced, especially by the so-called better classes or near society women. This is not to be deplored because the reproduction of their kind would not benefit the race. There are too many of them already.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, most newspapers reported this as a call for general race suicide, but the Sacramento Star's title was Slam at Near Society Women. I think they got it right because I think it was a slam at society women who talk about helping people, but don't actually do anything to better humanity.
Okay.
Do you think I'm reading too much into that?
It seems an odd thing for the woman to say.
Well, and again, I think it's taken out of context.
Yes.
I think, and from what I can see her making a really snarky comment like that.
Yes. Yes.
Now, potentially she's a horrible person. Potentially she murdered a bunch of people.
And you haven't given me a reason for these murders yet.
Money is primarily the reason, but there's more.
Okay. You did tell, yes, you did mention her husband's life insurance policy.
Right. And also, I think this kind of illustrates her character to me. And I think a lot of people knew about her. Like I said, this was national news and had this preconceived idea of her based on the press and what they had published.
Yes.
Okay. And also she was very strong-willed and opinionated, and she was a proponent of women's suffrage too. So I think there were a lot of people who had a lot of prejudices against her.
That I can see. Yes.
So since Dr. Ellis was a physician intensely interested in improving the welfare of people, especially children, to me, it makes sense she'd be a student of eugenics. Now, I can't swear that she was not racist or an advocate of forced sterilization, but I didn't find any mentions of this in descriptions of her work in the contemporary reports. Now, more recently, people have said things like she was really into sterilizing, she was racist. I don't know. I didn't find that, and I didn't have time to really dig into that. But in the contemporary newspaper articles, that was the only quote, the one I read you about this near society women going extinct, that that would even indicate anything like that.
Right.
All right, back to our story. So at the time of Mary Louise's death, Rita and Earl had been married for 2 years, and the two girls, sisters-in-law who lived in the same large home, were very close. The young girl's death, according to Dr. Catherine, had a profound impact on Rita. Catherine says Rita became extremely, what she called, health conscious. Dr. Alice later said Rita would frequently go downstairs to the basement surgery, where the scale was, to weigh herself without her clothes on. Now, I have to admit, when I weigh myself, I usually take my clothes off, but it's upstairs in my bathroom. I don't want any extra poundage on me.
No, neither do I. Yeah, I always take my shoes off at the doctor's office, regardless of what kind of shoes I'm wearing.
Exactly. Right. Now, looking at her actions, since she did go down there and weigh herself frequently, and she's described as being just a little thin, and she was a little depressed after her sister-in-law's death, I think she had at least some type of anorexia. But in 1933, that wouldn't have been something they'd know or diagnose.
It's very logical. Yes.
It does make sense. So Catherine said the whole family was devastated to learn of Mary Louise's passing. And we should note, after Rita's death, the newspapers all mentioned that Mary Louise's death was suspicious too. Now, I could not find that she had a life insurance policy. It seems likely that she did, because at the time of Rita's trial, Dr. Alice said that she had policies on all of her children.
A lot of people did that then. Sure. You know, they would have policies on all their children. And sometimes, sadly, it was just a burial policy, so you'd have money for the funeral. But yes,
I think that is actually about what it was. But the newspapers and the prosecutor, they thought that was suspicious. So then on May 8th of 1933, just a few months after Mary Louise's death, Enid Hennessy, remember I said she was living at the house too?
Yes.
Her elderly father was staying there too. He was an 85-year-old. He'd been staying at their house and he passed away. So newspapers would later report that his death was, quote, suspicious, and that he left a, quote, small estate to his daughter, Dr. Weinkoop's companion.
An 85-year-old?
Yes.
In 30-something is 1930. Suspicious?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big leap.
I think a lot of this is a big leap. In the fall of 1933, prior to Rita's murder, Dr. Alice had reported break-ins into her surgery, which was in the basement of the house, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, there were hidden panels people familiar with the house could use to enter and exit the lower level.
Spooky.
Yeah, actually, the newspapers described this house as gloomy and eerie. Dr. Alice said that the culprits were, quote, drug fiends who had stolen medication she'd stored down there where she kept her offices and her operating room. So now we're going to come to the tragedy that started the story, the murder of Rita Weinkoop. And this is from the New York Daily News, 1987, in an article entitled, "Greed Was the Motive of the Murderous Mother-in-Law." It's written recently, but this is what people believe about her now. Frail but iron-willed, Dr. Alice Lindsay Weinkoop had asked her mortician neighbor from Tom Ahern to come for the body of her daughter-in-law, attractive Rita Gardner Weinkoop, who had just died. Ahern knew Rita was only 23, the wife of the youngest Weinkoop, the weak, vacillating, and handsome Earl, 27. Ahern followed Dr. Weinkoop to her basement surgical facility adjacent to her consultation office. Rita lay face down on the operating table, a blanket shrouding her nearly nude body. As Ahern lifted the blanket, he was startled to find an ugly wound on the woman's back and her lips seared as if by acid. A .32 caliber revolver wrapped in gauze lay inches from her head. "This girl's been murdered," gasped Ahern. "Did you call the police?" Told by the doctor that she had not, Ahern made the call. The entire household was questioned. Dr. Weinkoop, self-possessed in such a shocking situation. Weinkoop's brilliant doctor daughter, Catherine, who could barely conceal her grief. Her other son, Walker, a successful businessman, and Enid Hennessy, who had boarded with the family for 10 years. Hennessy, a prim, dour teacher, was devastated. Earl, his mother's favorite, had gone to the Grand Canyon to take pictures. Dr. Weinkoop told police she had returned from afternoon shopping in time for dinner with Hennessy, and surprisingly, Rita did not show for the meal, the doctor said. Afterward, the two women talked. When Hennessy complained of a headache, the doctor went to her office for medicine and discovered the body. "It was about 8 p.m., she said. Asked why she had not called police immediately, Dr. Weinkoop explained, "I wish to avoid the publicity." She suggested robbery as a motive, noting 6 $1 bills had been taken from her desk and a .32 caliber revolver given to her by Earl was missing. Shown the gauze-wrapped weapon, she said it was hers. So that's from the article entitled "Murderous Mother-in-Law." That sounds pretty damning when you hear it said like that, doesn't it?
Yes. Now you're going to have to refresh me. Who owned the gun? It was the daughter. It wasn't Alice that owned the gun. It was Catherine, correct?
No, it was Earl.
Earl owned the gun. He gave it to somebody.
He gave it to his mom.
Oh, I'm lost.
Okay, go ahead. No, that's why you're here.
Oh, Earl. I'm sorry. Earl is the husband of Rita. Rita. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. I was listening. Okay. Earl's the husband of Rita. He gave the gun to his mother?
he and a friend were going to the Grand Canyon to take colored pictures.
I'm just wondering why he gave his mother a gun. Was that for her to protect the family while he was away? I don't understand.
Well, remember she had those break-ins?
Yes.
In the basement surgery. So I think that's the story. That's why.
Okay. All right.
Now, I mean, I'm making that up. I don't know, but that's what I think.
Mm-hmm. And he's the one that said that he gave the gun to his mother, or that. That's the story. We don't know that. This is the gun, the murder weapon?
Ah, well, we'll see.
Okay. All right.
Rita had been shot in the back with the bullet lodging in her breast. There were burns on her mouth, possibly from chloroform, and she had scratches and bruising on her face. Now, I did not see any mention of sexual assault, which could have been for a couple different reasons. Maybe because there hadn't been a sexual assault, or the police wished to keep that under wraps because it would have been unseemly to talk about it in 1933, or because it didn't fit with their explanation that they had developed of what happened.
All good reasons.
Well, I don't think the last one's a good reason, but yeah, potentially a real reason. Mm-hmm. So, of course, as they always do, they look at the family, at the household first, and their suspicion immediately fell on Dr. Alice and her son, Rita's husband, the weak, vacillating, and handsome Earl. While they worked to locate Earl, who was on his way home, they put together their own theory of events and explanations. Also, they allowed the press to spread rumor and innuendo about the residents of the huge and eerie Wine Coop home with its weirdly well-educated, strong-willed women. Like all that alliteration?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very proud of myself. Among the rumors spread were the theory that Earl was a womanizer and had a number of ladies on the string who worked at the World's Fair with him. They even reported that he'd given one of them Rita's engagement ring, stolen from her jewelry chest. Now, Dr. Catherine didn't 100% dispute this, but she did say that Rita and Earl, to her, seemed pretty happy with one another. Despite what I've read in the newspapers these last few weeks, I wasn't aware of any change between him and Rita. As far as I knew, he was going home every night. And I know she was always dashing down to the exposition to keep dates with him.
Like, when would he have had time to be a womanizer?
I don't know. And I mean, maybe he was. I don't know. This is what's been really confusing. And this is why it took me so long to put this together, because there's so many conflicting reports. And I wish I could go, you know, like the reports about her being interested in eugenics. I know somewhere somebody has the actual speeches she gave. But, you know, right now, especially with the pandemic, I can't go anywhere to find them. And they're not online, or at least anywhere I could find. So it's really frustrating to me because there's so many conflicting accounts of everything.
Yes. Yes. And it's beyond the scope of a weekly podcast.
It is, I think. I think it may be something somebody who's got more resources than I do can devote their time to it. Another rumor, in addition to the fact that he's supposedly this Lothario, is the word they keep using, is that Earl and Dr. Alice had a very strange relationship. Searching the home after Rita's death, they apparently found a very odd note that led the psychiatrist involved to suspect Earl and his mother had an unnatural attachment and that this was her motive to kill Rita. They found this note upstairs. "Precious, I'm choked. You are gone. You have called me up. And after 10 minutes or so, I called and called. No answer. Maybe you are sleeping. You need to be. But I want to hear your voice again tonight. I would give anything I have to spend an hour in real talk with you tonight. And I cannot. Good night." So this, they call it a letter. It was dated Sunday night. And I kind of think it sounds a little bit like a poem. I don't think it's a letter at all.
Was it just something written? Did it say to Earl from?
No, it said, "Precious, I'm choked."
So we have no idea who she was speaking of.
Well, I don't think so. But the police, well, let me read this. So the letter was dated Sunday night, and from what I can piece together, the note wasn't found underneath the dead girl's body, as some newspapers have reported, which sounds pretty damning if that's all the information you had. But it was upstairs among her papers in her study. So the police initially saw this note, and they thought some woman had written it to Earl. And so they confronted her with it, and she said that it was a note she had written, which the police took to mean it was a note she had written to him. And here's a quote from Virginia Gardner's Wine Coop Murder, How Woman Doctor Killed Son's Wife. "It was not until the next day that Dr. Wine Coop revealed that the mysterious letter was written by her to Earl. She said with flashing eyes that it was a, quote, love letter from a mother to her son. Later, psychiatrists were to find it significant, and at least one declared it indicated a possible Oedipus complex, or at any rate, an exaggerated maternal feeling. Now, this is the age of Freud, right? So these psychiatrists would have been looking for that, right?
Exactly.
So, and I'm extrapolating again, but in my head, it makes sense that she said, yeah, I wrote that. And then they're like, oh, you wrote it to Earl?
They assumed it was a romantic love when it really wasn't. If it was to Earl, it was just a mother to her son.
Well, I think it sounds kind of romantic, though, don't you?
Well, in today's world, it sounds romantic. I don't know what it would sound like in the 30s. People used more flowery speech then, didn't they?
They did. That's true. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it is an odd note if it's a note.
It is an odd.
To her son.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I will agree.
Right. And I am not sure what to believe because the admittedly frail Dr. Alice, who had suffered from health problems her entire life, was subjected to extensive and nearly brutal police questioning. A lot of this information, I mean, I found tons of different sources, but one of the sources that I really tend to believe the most in is a series of articles that Dr. Catherine wrote right after her mom had been sentenced. And so she said this about her mother's time with the police. Rita's death, an overwhelming catastrophe, was discovered by mother. In horror and consternation, she turned to me for help. Little did she realize that her every action must be weighed and measured carefully, that the investigation of Rita's death would follow a set routine and place the members of the household under suspicion first. She was so sincerely anxious to help clear up the mystery that she refused to follow her attorney's advice to say nothing further. After 4 or 5 interviews, during which she patiently answered questions and volunteered information, in an interval between her grillings, mother was allowed to take a sponge bath in the presence of a male officer. She was subjected to hours of hounding and misrepresentation. She was blindfolded and handcuffed much of the time.
Blindfolded?
And handcuffed.
Why blindfolded?
That was one of the techniques. I looked that up. It's like part of the whole third degree technique, which was one of the ways that they interrogated people.
Disorient you. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And actually, they had a picture on Wikipedia of the third degree, and a guy is like standing there blindfolded. So it was after a promise that if she would just make a statement that she would be permitted to go, that mother made her so-called confession, all of which admittedly was suggested to her. And then the papers said the reason she confessed was slightly different. They claimed that she had been told that Earl, who by this time was under interrogation himself, had confessed. And so she confessed to save him. The 1987 article said, and this is a quote, Earl was taking a lie detector test and stopped mid-test when he suspected he was failing and shouted, I'll give an ironclad confession to save the one I suspect.
Ah, okay.
Okay. So who knows what to believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of why she confessed, this is what her bizarre statement is, as reported in that same, the same article that said that Earl said he'd sign an ironclad confession.
Mm-hmm.
During the afternoon, Rita went to the surgery office and stripped away herself. Suddenly, she had a pain in her side, and Dr. Weinkoop suggested a whiff of chloroform to deaden the nerves while she worked on her daughter-in-law's side. Rita agreed, which accounted for her burned lip. I massaged her for about 15 minutes, and then I noticed that she seemed to be passing away, the doctor related. Panicked by the thought her medical career had been ruined by prescribing an overdose of chloroform, the doctor thought of the gun and fired the shot into Rita to make it look like a robbery. So does that make sense?
That's plausible. That is plausible. I think that's plausible.
Okay.
If she was really bulimic, she may have the pain in her side, could have been from some kind of internal injuries.
Okay.
And if that was the case, then giving her the chloroform and then massaging her side.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand how she probably was going to die anyway. And then when she decided to cover it up, I agree with you. I don't think it was murder.
Okay. So I didn't think that made sense, but maybe. 2 days after she signed this confession, Dr. Alice recanted the statement saying that Dr. Hoffman, the county psychiatrist, the one who had diagnosed those exaggerated maternal feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Had convinced her that Earl had already confessed and that she had a chance to take the fall for him by an act of medical malpractice instead of murder, which would have been his crime, right?
Right.
Now, her motive in that confession is to cover up her malpractice by staging a break-in, which isn't a lot of fun for newspapers and might not sway a jury to convict her. Also, Rita's father, who's always referred to as that salt and flour broker from Indianapolis, was convinced that the wine coops had killed his daughter and actually testified against Dr. Alice at the trial. So police, with the help of psychiatrists who were pushing this Oedipal complex idea, came up with their own theory, their own motive, that Dr. Alice knew her beloved Earl was unhappily married. She was broke. She hated Earl's wife. And so she killed her to free him from the marriage to one who was his inferior and collect on Rita's life insurance. Hmm.
Do you find anything that says how much these life insurance policies were worth?
So that's a good question. Actually, I'm going to talk about that now. Huh, it's in here.
All right.
Okay. The money angle is the only thing that even sort of makes sense as a motive, but I don't have the time or resources to fully investigate it, as I said before. The papers say that Dr. Alice was flat broke. I think one said she owed the butcher, the baker, and the undertaker, that she only had $26 in the bank and she owed $3,500 on the mansion. They make a big deal of saying that her husband, Dr. Frank's life insurance policy payout was $75,000 or $80,000, which is $1.6 million today. But, you know, he was the breadwinner of the family, so I don't think that's all that unusual. Oh, and then they also point out that all of that money was gone.
Where did it go in that short period of time?
Well, that's what they say. They're like, where did it go? But okay, it was the beginning of the Great Depression. So a lot of people suddenly went completely broke.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes. 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 I mean, she might have been lucky to get the life insurance paid.
Right. Exactly. Maybe they didn't even pay it. I don't even know. Yeah.
Okay.
Apparently, Dr. Alice had taken out a policy on Rita, and she'd paid the premiums herself only a few months before Rita's death. And it was like a double indemnity clause where if she died in a violent death, it was doubled. So it was a $5,000 policy, but if she died a violent death, then it was $10,000.
So shooting her up to her life insurance by $5,000.
Potentially.
Okay.
So I'll admit that this part of the story seems suspicious. And Dr. Catherine says nothing to explain the life insurance policies. Dr. Alice said she took out the policy to bolster Rita's confidence in her own health. Because remember, she was all worried about her health. So she said, look, you're going to pass this physical. You're fine. I'll even pay for the insurance. Again, Catherine said that her mom and Rita got along great. Enid Hennessy, the boarder, seemed to think they got along well, too. Perhaps they did. Perhaps they didn't. Remember, this woman is super smart. So maybe she's a major sociopath or psychopath. I don't know. However, Dr. Alice was convicted of the murder and she was sentenced to 25 years. She was released after 13 years on account of good behavior. And she died 2 years later at a rest home. Earl changed his name, moved to California, where he worked for an aviation company of some kind. He remarried and he lived to a ripe old age. Dr. Catherine worked as an OB until she was in, this is amazing, until she was in her early 80s.
Wow.
And she died at 91. I found some amazing articles about her. She's just this tiny, adorable lady. And she was married for a brief time. She changed her name to Dobson, but she got a divorce. But there was an article I read where she was 88 or something. And she said she was divorced, but she was still looking. It was really cute.
And she was eight when she was age 88.
Yeah, I think so. Something like that.
Wow.
So now there's one other thing I want to add to this story. I read on a message board that the Winecoop family knows that Dr. Alice's brother-in-law confessed on his deathbed to killing Rita. So I looked and looked and looked for this confession, and I never found anything. But Dr. Gilbert Winecoop as the killer makes a lot of sense. He certainly seems a more likely killer than Dr. Alice or Earl. One, he was addicted to narcotics. Two, his wife had divorced him because he tried to strangle her. Three, he was then being investigated and was brought to trial sometime after Rita's murder for attempted rape of a nurse. He was found insane, so he was sent to an asylum instead of a prison for this. Now, remember also how I mentioned that there had been break-ins prior to Rita's murder?
Yes.
And that the thieves had stolen drugs?
Yes.
Also, remember that there was that secret entrance to the medical offices that the family members all knew about?
Yes.
While I couldn't find evidence of the confession, I did find this in a 1951 Decatur Herald article. Dr. Gilbert Winecoop, 71, a narcotics addict himself, was sentenced to 2 years in a federal hospital today for prescribing dope illegally to addicts. I think that adds a completely different wrinkle to the whole story. And I don't understand why the police didn't fully investigate him.
I don't either. Unless they were trying to get rid of this woman who was telling people every man, woman, child who is an adult, married or not, should be adopting children. Well, I said every man, woman, and child, every man and woman of age should adopt a child, whether they were married or not. That sounds like she had some unpopular beliefs, and she was very active in promoting some of her unpopular beliefs.
That is very well stated. I agree with that. I think that's true. So that's pretty much all I have another 15 pages written, but I'm not going to read it. I had a hard time condensing it to this, but that's the condensed version of the conviction of Dr. Alice Lois Lindsay Wynkoop. Do you have any questions? I know it's confusing.
It is very confusing.
Did you follow the story though? Or is it?
Oh, I think I followed the story. I think I've got it. And I don't know what your facts are going to be, but I picked something out I think is a fiction. So we'll see.
Okay.
All right.
We're going to pause for a message from our sponsor, Bell Toffee, and then we'll be right back to play Fact or Fiction.
Bell Toffee, the toffee made from Aunt Ida Bell's secret family recipe, uses only quality ingredients like Belgian and Colombian chocolate, pure cane sugar, creamery butter, almonds from California, and hazelnuts from Oregon. Made in small batches, Bell Toffee comes in a variety of luscious flavors: bourbon pecan, milk chocolate almond, dark chocolate almond, and roasted hazelnut espresso. Bell Toffee is available in beautiful, resealable foil bags and attractive tins, making it a perfect gift for the holidays, corporate events, weddings, showers, and any other occasion where you want to make an impression. You'll feel good knowing that you're sharing a quality item with the important people in your life. And they've made it so easy. Now you can place an order on the Bell Toffee website, and they'll ship it right to the address you provide. Go to belltoffee.com to order a bag or a tin to show appreciation to the people in your life. That's BellToffee.com. While you're there, order a little something for yourself. You too deserve to experience the signature toffee crush.
Hi, welcome back, Mom. Let's play. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Choice number one, the quote, "You tell me that woman who is evidently talking through her bonnet, that as far as I'm concerned, although I'm a batch, I'm taking care of 10 or 12 now, and I think that's enough." So did I make that up, or is that real? Papers reported that Earl was taking a lie detector test and stopped mid-test when he suspected he was failing and shouted, "I'll sign an ironclad confession to save the one I suspect." Choice number three. Under interrogation, Dr. Alice was subjected to hours of hounding and misrepresentation. She was blindfolded and handcuffed much of the time. And choice number four. Rita's father was convinced that the Wynkoops had killed his daughter and actually testified against Dr. Alice at the trial. So, Mom, what do you think?
I hope that the newspaper article about the bachelors is real, because I really like that.
I know. Isn't that funny?
If you made it up, it's a good story. Okay. Because I just think it was neat. And I can believe that a single man would think it was absolutely absurd for him, for most single men. I'm not going to say, because there are single men who will adopt children, but, and there's nothing wrong with that. But in that time, I think a single man would think it was absolutely absurd to go out and adopt a child.
Okay.
I mean, it would affect his prospects of marriage, et cetera, et cetera. Just, you know, it would add a complication that they wouldn't need to their lives. Mm-hmm. The other one, Alice, for hours of interrogation, blindfolded. I think that they had it out for this woman, and I think they were going to do whatever it took to get her to confess. Maybe I've watched too much television, but I think that's very likely. Mm-hmm. I also think that a bereaved father who had lost his young daughter, and didn't they live some distance away?
Yeah, they were from Indianapolis, so... It's not,
I mean, yeah, in today's world, it wouldn't be a long way, but then it would have been mm-hmm. a distance. He probably didn't see her frequently. And I can understand how a bereaved father would say, I think you're at fault, regardless of whether he thought that Alice was the one that murdered her. He felt that the family was at fault for not protecting his daughter. And so that's how it came out. Now, the one that I don't believe is the lie detector test for Earl, because I don't know, when did they first develop a lie detector test? Maybe they were out there then. You didn't give me time to look it up, but I just don't think that this young man, I don't think he would have done that. So I think that that is a fiction. And as usual, I'm sure I got it wrong, because out of all your facts and fictions, I think I've gotten two right.
So the lie detector was actually invented in 1921.
Oh, so it was available. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
But you can't change your choice now. So
I'm not going to change my choice. That wasn't the only reason. All the time on television shows, there's like, oh, to protect my mother, I'm going to do this. To protect my son, I just don't buy it. Okay. So don't go out and commit a murder and expect your mother to be the fall guy, okay?
Fine. Just be that way. You don't really love me. All right. So, so the quote, you'll be happy to know, is actually true. And I don't know if the guy actually said that, or the newspaper man made it up or whatever, but I agree with you. I like the evidently talking through her bonnet part. That just cracked me up. Mm-hmm. And I thought it sounded kind of like something I would make up. The report that Earl was taking a lie detector test and stopped mid-test, that was actually in a newspaper article. Now, I don't know if he did that or not. That's what it was. It was there.
Okay.
Rita's father was convinced that the wine coops had killed his daughter, and he did testify against Dr. Alice at the trial. I suspect that he was a little prejudiced against the women in the family, and maybe a little bit jealous, because from what I read, it sounded like Rita really liked the wine coops. And maybe preferred living with them to living at home with her new stepmother. But the story I made up was the blindfolded and handcuffed. Now, they did interrogate her. And the story about the sponge bath with the male police officer.
I forgot about that. That might have been. Did they do that?
They did do that.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what Catherine said.
Okay.
You know, she said that her mom was subjected to that, and I see no reason for her to lie about that. It just seems like exactly the kind of thing that detectives giving somebody the third degree back in 1933 would have done. And that's what she said. Now, the blindfold and handcuffed, I made that up. They may have done that. I never saw that anywhere, but I did. I was looking up interrogation techniques of 1933, and there really was a picture of a man blindfolded being interrogated. So that's where I got that.
Curses foiled again.
You plan on saying that for the whole time. All right. Well, that's fact or fiction.
Okay.
Thanks again, Mom, for being my guest. And thank you to all of the listeners out there. I hope you were as intrigued as I was by the story of Dr. Alice Lois Lindsay Winecoop and the tragic murder of her daughter-in-law, Rita. You can find a list of my sources and pictures related to today's episode on my website, www.factorfictionpodcast.com. I'll be back next week with another short Phiblet episode. Until then, listen closely, because it's difficult to know if what you hear is fact or fiction. Goodbye.